Now that I've talked about lack of healthy community in society and the church, I've talked about the hallmarks of healthy community, and I've talked about a theology for community, I'm going to go on to a section on small group life, because that is where community is best lived out. Community happens, as I said before, when people commune with God and each other. And for that to happen, we can't sit like those attached chairs in an airport terminal. You know, I'm reminded of that image because I was part of a group that did try to do that. A number of church leaders were together to discuss a very delicate situation, and they were crisscrossing the country and met at the airport terminal. And I'm sure that you would agree it was impossible to work out the details of something very delicate and sensitive when we were all lined up in those rigid little chairs in a row and weren't able to face each other and really eye to eye understand one another. That's why I say community is best lived out in the circle of small group life. Friendships are the building blocks of community. So we want to make it easy for everyone in the church to form friendships, to join small groups, to find friendships within Sunday school classes, and so on. Ted Haggard says, "Any demon, no matter how weak, can penetrate a corporate structure, but no demon, no matter how strong, can penetrate genuine friendship." As one pastor said to me recently, "The people in the small groups in our church are not my difficult people. They are my contributors. They're my resource people. They are not the problems. They are the solutions. It is a delight to be a resource to them." So body life, it happens when two or three are gathered in my name and I'm in the midst of them. It happens in those small group settings of, say, 5 or 10, at the most 15 people. They are the venue in the church where body life can most effectively take place. So what is body life? It's certainly not that obligatory potluck or carry-in. It's not the coffee that we offer after the real meeting. It is not socializing. And if you're a Myers-Briggs person, it's not an NF thing. Body life is not merely a psychological power of the group dynamic. Instead, body life provides us with excellent opportunities to grow in relational skills as well as faith. Here is where we learn how to be a true friend, not an adversarial problem person. Body life is that interaction that goes far beyond good listening skills, or "I'll remember you in prayer this week." It is not just perfunctory gestures of support or a few quick pieces of advice. Rather, it's that week-in and week-out commitment to help one another discover God in the midst of crisis, as well as in the midst of the gnawing grind of everyday life. To summarize Crabb, he says soul wounds are the problem for most of us, not so much psychological disorders which demand trained specialists, which is what has been assumed for most of this century. Disconnected souls, he says, not damaged psyches, are the problem. What is needed is connection, the regenerating power of body life. Well, as I said, body life happens most consistently in ongoing small group settings. And of course, the best example was Jesus and the disciples. Jesus had 12 in his small group, and that's, by the way, an optimum size. And he had 3 or 4 very close friends within that group. He also related to the 70 or so in a wider circle. But it was mainly here, in his small group of 12 disciples, that he taught us how to deal with difficult people and work through relational conflict. The best environment for closeness, says John White and Ken Blue in their book Healing the Wounded, is the small home group, which becomes family to one another. Here, there is a place for caring for each other, training, mentoring, and daring to be accountable to each other for one's actions and attitudes. And here's something to think about. What are the dimensions of the small group life in your church? This is another way to describe community, by its measurements, as Tom Attlee, editor of Think Peace magazine, writes. So what are the measurements, the length, the breadth, and the depth of the small groups that you know? The length, how long your community, your small group, has shared experience, and how committed you are to continue that sharing. The breadth, how many facets of your life do you share, and how wide a range of people and experiences do you include? And the depth, how deeply, thoroughly, or intimately you share. A small group, if it's doing its job well, answers our basic need for relationships of unabashed, over-the-top acceptance and encouragement of each other, just because we showed up on the planet, not because we have it all together, we've arrived, we're mature, we make all the right choices, and we're hardly ever difficult. It is such a group that knows that change comes to us only as we experience, as Crabb says, the laughing, accepting heart of Father God and give it to each other. And Crabb cites the work of the great revivalist Jonathan Edwards when he talks about the need to mortify our flesh and vivify our spirit. Ultimately, it's just not helpful to exhume, examine, and fixate on our difficult side. The Bible calls it our flesh, and it just needs to be shot, or mortified, as Jonathan Edwards would say, as we count ourselves dead to sin, which in Crabb's words is any sense of adequacy or satisfaction outside of Jesus. The deeds of the flesh are those bad urges which are not at the core of us, but to which we still succumb. Maturation comes as we nourish and release the good urges. In other words, Jonathan Edwards' vivifying of our spirit with the life of Christ, and put to death the deeds of the flesh through relationship with God, of course, but also with each other. This is what brothers and sisters do for one another. They help us put off the old by interceding for us, warring on our behalf, by committing to being with us in, as Crabb would say, our God-mandated desert time, which is wonderfully helpful for killing flesh, and by loving us too much not to hold us accountable to loving ourselves and to walking in holiness. Brothers and sisters also help us put on the new by stimulating us to love and good deeds and by identifying the likeness of Jesus in us and nourishing and celebrating it until it grows and crowds out all our old sinful ways. Small group life also trains people for leadership. It keeps the church gainfully employed and releases real ministry. It trains people for leadership, not just to sign them up for ushering. The church was never meant to have the upfronters versus the outbackers, was it? Why are one or two official Christian leaders assigned the job of pastor and expected to carry a load that belongs on many shoulders? The gulf, the separation between clergy and laity is traditional but not biblical, nor is the typical 20% of the members doing 80% of the work God's design either. The biblical model is shared leadership and team ministry. And that happens best within the environment of small groups. Small groups require a dispersion of leadership. It spreads around the responsibility. Now, the pastor isn't the focus of every disgruntled person in the church. In a good sense, it downplays the pastor's importance. He is not the answer to every church problem, nor is he the cause of it. But when the church is structured around everything being dependent on him, rather than being dispersed throughout community life, then when he is seen as difficult, there are immediate repercussions because so much authority is vested in him. There is nowhere else to go. Larry Stockstill, the author of The Cell Church, Preparing Your Church for the Coming Harvest, is one of many pastors now having small groups as the only program in the church. Here are some of his observations. He says that small groups have really simplified the entire ministry of the church, because now small groups do the work that programs used to do previously. So small groups do pastoral care, they do benevolence, they do hospital visitation, small groups do the follow-up of new believers, they assist at the services, they pray for missions, they're instrumental in helping in outreach and work functions in the church, such as the nursery, the greeters, and so on. With small groups, opportunity was being given for everyone to grow in their spiritual gifts and ministries. And this is quite different than most churches, isn't it? Where several gifted individuals, as we said, direct more or less passive observers. Stockstill also realized that the small groups were uncovering many counseling issues. These heretofore had been hidden, but now they were coming to light, and they were able to be dealt with mostly within the small group itself. He realized that the small groups were exposing problems. They were exposing the hidden sin that was in the church all along. When the members got into a caring small group, they wanted to unburden themselves. And during the first 2 years of small group life, very serious sin had begun to be exposed. At first, the leadership thought that believers were just falling into terrible sin, but actually they were falling out of it. The small group members were becoming part of a caring environment which helped them walk out of their problems in a way that family conferences, regular services, or even one-to-one counseling hadn't been able to do before. You might recall me saying that small groups, to really be functioning effectively, took a lot of perseverance and hard work. I should also say that every small group will try at first to avoid its difficult side before facing it and coming into closeness. And here I'll just briefly mention Peck's work on the stages of community in his work, A Different Drum. He says that every group has a task. This can be conscious and stated, explicit, or less conscious and more implicit. Furthermore, he says all groups try to avoid their task and try pseudo-community first. The basic assumption of pseudo-community is that the problem of individual differences should be avoided. There is great fear about conflict of any kind, healthy or not. So pseudo-community is where everybody is being nice. They're hiding conflict beneath congeniality, cooperating on projects perhaps, but they're not really connecting. Peck says, however, this is impossible to maintain. Conflict will inevitably and finally erupt, and individual differences will come out. This is the chaos stage. Now the question becomes, are we going to shut it down or work through our relationships? Then, says Peck, we come to the most scary part, the emptiness phase, where everyone within the group must empty himself or herself of all their agendas they need to control before coming to the final stage. That final stage is, then, true community, where we can talk about ourselves in an open, vulnerable way. And we would go further than Peck by saying, and also to talk about the solutions that can be found only in Jesus, and to pray for one another very openly and honestly and without pretense. To conclude this section on small groups, I want to talk for a few moments about the role of the wise helper. These are the spiritual mothers or fathers, the mentors, the spiritual advisors that are so effective in dealing with all of us difficult people. The small group is the natural place where these mentors, wise helpers, can be discovered, raised up and released, and connected with all of those who need this kind of relationship, which, in my opinion, is all of us. Here's an example of what happens to me so frequently. I was at a church to do a seminar with my husband, and before the service, a woman we'll call Mary came up to me and said, "I know you are a trained counselor. Could you please help my friend Sue? She's in really bad shape." I found out that Mary had been befriending Sue, been available to her, being a mentor to her, really. Even though Mary didn't have the terminology for that, that was in fact what she was doing. Mary was totally standing by Sue to pray for her and support her as Sue learned to live victoriously and peacefully with her difficult person, who in this case was her husband. So here is Sue. She has the benefit of a good church community. She has a small group. And she has Mary, a wise, helpful friend. But both Mary and Sue, though, thought that somehow, because I was a trained counselor, I had the magic bullet to fix the problems. We need to re-educate our people that mentors, spiritual advisors, the leaders of small groups, are the appropriate place for, in so many cases, the confession, absolution, blessing, and follow-up that we need. As James 5 says, confess your faults one to another that you may be healed. This kind of formal confession, by the way, outside the counselor's office, is currently devalued. Of course, we don't want to bring back the medieval confessional, but a few moments of silent prayer before communion doesn't cut it either. Carl Jung said earlier in the century, and it is still true, that confession is now the domain of the counselor's office, that therapists have replaced priests and wise elders. Usually mentoring is far more effective than professional therapy or even professional clergy. Certainly it is more helpful than programs to fill our perceived needs. As Paul says, we don't have many fathers, those that will mentor or teach us in the faith. Now, as I said, I am a professional counselor, and there are certain cases where my skills would be necessary, or medical or psychiatric intervention would be necessary. But these cases are small compared to the number of people who come for counseling. Psychology in itself is in chaos. Psychologists Patterson and Hidor, in their book Successful Psychotherapy, A Caring, Loving Relationship, say, forget trying to find the disorder and then treat it. Instead, focus on one idea, that successful psychotherapy is love. But now, isn't that brilliant? And then they go on to add, but can love be bought? Can you pay your psychotherapist to love you? Crabb says that in his master's program in counseling at the university where he teaches, they have now shifted to a spiritual formation model of personal change. They're helping their students, instead of becoming counselors, to become spiritual friends and spiritual directors. Well, let me summarize what Crabb says is what he needs from a helping person. And being a therapist also, I would say this is certainly what I need. Well, to summarize, Crabb, he says our wounds will never be healed completely until we get to heaven. We will always struggle. So don't try to fix me, please. Show me instead God at work through it all. Listen to me and be curious about what God is doing in my struggles. Discern where the Spirit is working, more than trying to find out all the details of the troubles. Just be with me, more than trying to anxiously figure out how to help. I will let you climb into my soul. I will open myself to you if you are broken yet strong, vulnerable and hopeful and respectfully curious about what God is up to with me. Really? A broken person as a helper? Or as Nouwen would say, a wounded healer? Yes, because it is our weakness, our humility, that ultimately draws people to us, not our competence. It is our admitted failures, not our paraded successes, that bond us together in hope. We must expose our specific failure at least to one other person. Not to label each other for our problems or diagnoses, but to document, as it were, the fact that despite our brokenness, we see the radiant life of Jesus like silver underneath the tarnish. That rings so true to me, because, you see, I don't want to be in a community of intact, together, know-it-all, proud folks who admit neither fault nor temptation. Those, I have to tell you, are my ultimate difficult people. Instead, I want to be in a community of people who are broken because we've allowed God to break us. And in the words of the old chorus, to mold us, make us, fill us, and use us. Yes, I want to be among broken people who have hit the bottom and have survived, and that will hit lower bottoms yet, possibly, and still survive. No, not just survive, but really thrive. These people don't have to be clever for me. They don't have to have a lot of academic degrees. They don't have to pull out just the right solution for my problems out of their little bag of tricks. These people want me to change and grow, but I don't have to just for their sake. As Crabbe said, these kinds of people we can hurt, but we can't destroy. They do not have poor me, take care of me attitudes. They feel their neediness, but we feel their strength. They always find reason to worship God and celebrate us. We don't feel used by them, because their center is already solid. They don't need us to validate them, because that's already being done by Jesus. And here we come to the conclusion of this course. We are in for difficult times, not just for difficult people. And once again, our model is Jesus. He formed a community out of difficult people during difficult times. Jesus called a bunch of difficult people into community and ate with them, slept with them, fully entered into their joys and sorrows. He loved them to life, and they in turn went out and turned the world upside down. We too are called to fulfill the Great Commission, to compel the world to say, look how they love, and so be inexorably drawn into the kingdom. 2 Peter 1, 5-11 says, we are to apply all diligence to our faith, supply moral excellence, knowledge, self-control, perseverance, godliness, brotherly kindness, Christian love. For if these qualities are yours and increasing, they render you neither useless nor unfruitful. He who lacks these qualities is blind or short-sighted. As long as you practice these things, you will never stumble. And 1 Peter 4:8 says, above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. It is my deep conviction that difficult times are ahead for the church. Our brothers and sisters are going through hard times in other parts of the world, and I don't believe we will escape major changes in our own life here in the United States. It will come a day when getting along will not be a luxury, but a necessity. We have a Chinese pastor friend in Los Angeles, and he was raised in Red China and he was part of the underground church there, and he later fled the country. And this is what he said, and I've never forgotten it. He said, in communist China, we believers had to pull together against the enemy. There was no time to waste on unessentials. We had to be focused on our priorities. We just had no time or energy to be bickering with each other. We couldn't indulge in petty differences. We just couldn't resign ourselves to being each other's difficult people. We had to learn to get along. It was quite often a matter of life and death. My husband John and I have been involved in community throughout our marriage. We were on a mission ship. We were ministering in a community-structured church in England. In one of the churches that we pastored in, we lived in co-housing together with the associate pastor and his wife. Now, that one I wouldn't recommend unless God absolutely told you to do it, because it's a tailor-made setup for bringing out every last difficult part of your old sin nature, believe me. We've also been privileged to lead or participate in small groups of all kinds throughout our life together. But a number of months ago, we realized anew the power of community. John had had a severe dog bite, and it had become infected. And so several people gathered around us to pray for him. We had stayed as guests in each one of these people's homes. They knew us very well, and we them. They had a heart for us and a vision for what God was doing in us. They prayed so powerfully, not just because they're mature, anointed prayer warriors, but because they had taken us into their lives as kin. We felt supported and cared for and empowered. A great weight came off our shoulders. We just knew that God was going to take care of this dog bite, as well as some other situations that we'd really felt bitten by at the time. Certainly, as 1 Corinthians 1 says, there will always be divisions, factions, and personal antagonisms, but it is the cross we must always return to. For to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. God has chosen us weak ones, so very flawed, who even after we absorb all this material about difficult people, will stumble, because no one but God Himself is to get the glory. It is the wisdom of the Spirit that will keep us moving in our own maturation and in being able to deal well with the difficult people that come our way. Let us then, my friends, have no debt remaining outstanding, but the continuing debt to love each other, as Romans 13 says. Let us love one another to life, incite one another to good works, and together go out and win the harvest. We have come now to the end of 8 and the end of this course. I hope the ideas and concepts that have been presented in the last 8 hours will be useful to you in relating to all those that God has called you to love. May God bless you and give you hope and a confidence born of humility in dealing with difficult people.